Natasha Wilch, welcome to the Hear Us Out podcast today. Thank you for taking your time to be our guest. And we would love to hear from you about what got you into work in the concussion space.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I loved getting your message. I was like, yes, absolutely.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, so I'm a physical therapist, and so I specialize in concussion, and I own a brick and mortar clinic that's multidisciplinary up here in Nanaimo, British Columbia. And then I have a huge mission around concussion. So I also mentor other clinicians in teaching them how to rehab concussion, and I work with individuals around the world on their own healing journeys as well. I say it's always one of those things that if you had asked me if I ever wanted to work with concussion, the answer was no. And life just kind of drops things in your lap sometimes at how they're supposed to unfold. And I'd moved to Nanaimo, and I honestly had an occupational therapist refer me a concussion client who wasn't recovering. So she was in persistent concussion stages. And the reason she got referred to me is because I was a neurophysio. So I did a lot of stroke, a lot of Parkinson's, a lot of MS. And this OT's thought process was, well, Natasha works with neuro, and neuro's the brain, and let's refer her to Natasha, which, side tangent, I do this all the time, is I think how a lot of people mistakenly get referred to neurologists right away too, but we can talk about that after if you want. So this woman ends up in my clinic, and I looked at her and I just said, I'm going to be brutally honest, like, I have no idea what to do. I said, but if you're willing to work with me, I'm willing to learn. And I always say, I think it's because she had nowhere else to go that she stayed. So thank gosh.
I like how you said that, because a conversation we consistently have with students is, it's okay to not know the answer, but you need to be able to explain why you don't know or why the field doesn't know. Not just that you haven't done the work, but that, hey, we don't have answers for everything. Sometimes we're making the best guess that we can to try and get it right for you. So in your conversations with her, what did you use to establish rapport and build confidence, even though you lead the conversation with, hey, I'm just not sure?
Yeah. I think it truly is that being vulnerable. There's this place in all our professions that we feel like we need to be the expert. And it's hard when this person, especially in private practice, when someone is coming to pay you for a service and you're supposed to be the expert, to feel like you don't know what the heck you're doing. It's kind of a beat on your own confidence. It's like you're worried about what someone's going to, how that's going to be reflected. But being vulnerable and openly saying to someone, I don't know what this is, but I'm willing to learn, or, but I, let's help find a referral source to support you who can, and let's do this. So it's this piece of, I'm human, and being able to show that to that person will still be compassionate and establishing what I do know, and that I'm willing to take the step, because with her, I very much was, to do the next thing. That in itself is a huge rapport builder.
Do you tend to find that the, I don't know if it's the answers, but the next steps tend to be within your own field, or do you have to find that it's another professional you refer outwards?
Yeah, that very much depends on the person, honestly. So, most of my clients end up in front of, so my clients fly to me from all over the world to come rehab their concussions. So the clients that end up in front of me are typically the people who have tried everything, in air quotes. They're the clients that have seen 20 physical therapists and 10 chiropractors and all the specialists. Those are the people that end up in front of me. Doesn't mean that I'm still not referring to other professions. And typically, the things that kind of get at that point, I always say they need this like multi-systems assessment, which is what I, in an integrated assessment, which is what I specialize in. But for many of them, it's not necessarily referral within my same profession. It might be if they're leaving my clinic to go back to their hometown, but it's also looking at, what are the other professions we need to pull into play? What else have I identified in my systems assessment that is a factor here that is not something that I treat, but we need to pull our team members in? Central auditory processing is one of the big things that obviously I don't assess and treat. And we are lucky in that on Vancouver Island, we have two places that will assess and treat central auditory processing disorders. that's something that definitely doesn't. If someone really needs support with metabolics or nutrition or hormones, that's absolutely something I refer out for. If someone needs more specific upper cervical care, that's absolutely something I refer out for. But it very much depends on the person as to who the referral is going to be, or whether it's going to be someone else within my field who is that piece fit. It just depends.
So with what you're saying, there's two questions I think of. One, I'm very curious, what are those steps that people have taken in the try everything process before they get to you? And the second is, I'm also curious about similarities in symptom and presentation of stroke and concussion.
So the try everything is usually, they've seen traditional physical therapy and multiple different therapists. They've, you know, I'm going to say failed out of traditional vestibular rehab programs, or they've seen physiatrists and neurologists and whoever else that have told them, like, this is just your new normal, all the myths and all the sentences that like drive me bonkers and like fuel my fire to keep doing my mission, to be honest. You know, they've seen multiple chiropractors, they'll have seen just multiple people from different professions, and they're feeling very stuck because they're not making progress. That's usually what the like I've tried everything looks like. So they've seen multiple people. It could be both traditional medicine, it could be they've like factored in some like alternative medicine in there too. And they're just stuck. They're not seeing the progress they want to make. And so then people kind of get to this point of like, you know, when you've seen double digit providers and you feel like you're not changing, they reach this point of like, do I keep going or do I just accept that this is the way it is? And it's a hard spot to be in, I think, when someone's been on this journey for years. And so when I say to people, like, basically, like, my gift is moving people from stuck to excelling. Not like that. Like, it's, I always say, like, coming to work with me for a week is not a miracle. There's still work. And it still takes time. But up to this point, they've gone through a very traditional approach to concussion, which I always say is a very siloed approach to concussion for many people. So they'll see a chiro or an ortho PT for their neck, and then they'll see someone else for their vestibular system, and then they might see a neurooptometrist for vision, but everyone is working very siloed in their approaches and no one is coming together and integrating the systems. Whereas I do system integration from day one, and so it just helps people get that huge step forward to then continue to have recovery down the road, even if it's been years. That would be that question. Similarities between stroke. They're completely different.
Okay.
So it's not to say that
expose
like
expose our lack of knowledge here on this.
That's
topic,
okay.
Which is part of why we want to have the conversation.
Yeah. So stroke is, you know, there's been either a bleed or an ischemic stroke, right? So there's actual pathological damage to the brain of a stroke. And like actual like neurons have died and all this lovely thing. And not stroke is not lovely, but right. And so this is what I used to do all the time. Now the beautiful thing with stroke is, you know what's happened, you know where in the brain it's happened, you know the extent of the actual damage to the brain that's there. Now that does not mean that CT scan that shows that dictates your rehab, because we know the concepts of neuroplasticity, and the brain can absolutely rewire and different portions of the brain can take over parts of damaged brain. You need the rehab to do it. But so stroke, biggest thing is stroke, there is actual physical like damage in the brain that you can see on an MRI. Concussion, there is not. Mm-hmm. Right. So concussion, you cannot see physical damage on the brain. Every like a CT and MRI and X-ray is going to be absolutely normal. And a stroke, whereas we know there is a like focalized place of injury, a concussion is a diffuse injury. Right. So it's that acceleration, deceleration, how the brain moves in the skull, how it might rotate in the skull that then dictates damage. So versus a concussion can have diffuse challenges in how the pathways within the brain really communicate together. And that you determine what part of the brain is injured in a concussion because of the functional testing that we do, because we can't see anything on an image, right? So a stroke diagnosis is very much like it's seen on CT, it's seen on MRI, do they have to go in and take care of it in certain ways? That's that way. A concussion is a very clinical diagnosis. So the diagnosis is initially based on symptomology and mechanism. And then when determining what we need to do for rehab and the area of greatest area of injury within the brain, that's determined with functional testing and objective testing in the clinic to determine then how we approach rehab from there.
Is there, so I know that there are some people out there that have a history of concussions. They've gotten 3, 4, 5. Is there a difference in how people interact with you or come into your office for the first time if they've had their first concussion versus if they've had a history of it?
Good question. Not really. You know, I'd say the one difference is if someone has had a concussion, so in the multiple concussion scenario, if someone's had multiple concussions and any of those concussions or like their most recent concussion took months to recover, they're definitely a bit more like, what do we do? Like, I can't do that again. Versus somebody, and so they take it a little more, they might take it a little more seriously, versus somebody who it's their first concussion. You know, the myth around out there is still like 80% of people get better in 10 days, right? Like that's still, or like you shake it off and you'll be good in a couple days. Like that is still one of the prevalent narratives that is so inaccurate. It's not even funny. But that's still what people think. It's just a bonk to the head. But I will say, so sometimes that acute is a little bit more challenging to get to adhere to things. That being said, people want to get better. The biggest thing I think too, in that acute phase of concussion, if it's their first one, if they are quite symptomatic, there is the fear of the unknown. Like they don't know what they're getting into. Like this is new. Like the symptoms they're experiencing might not make logical sense to them because it's like, how are my emotions linked to the fact that I feel like I'm dizzy and my thought processes are slow, right? Like how does this, like how do these things connect? And so a lot of people still don't have a lot of knowledge around concussion. And so the anxiety levels of just not understanding what's happening in their body and not feeling like themselves at all is higher in the beginning versus if they've had a concussion before, they understand this part of it. They understand it's linked. And now they're ready to like do the work to fix it again.
For people who are listening that have experienced, I'll use the general term head trauma. They're okay. Trying to decide, was it a bump to the head or was it something more serious that needs further evaluation? What sort of guidance would you give to people in how to interpret what their experience was? Was this something I need to take seriously versus it was a bump on the head?
If you hit your head and you have symptoms within 24 hours, go get an assessment.
So it's pretty simple.
And I say that because the research shows us, and your symptoms might resolve in a few days. Cool. Amazing. But the research shows us again and again at this point that if you are someone that has a concussion or a suspected, that would be like a suspected concussion, the sooner you collect, the sooner you connect with a concussion specific provider, the faster your recovery is going to be. So take that person, for example, they bonked their head. They're feeling a little dizzy. Dizzy headache are the two most kind of common symptoms, right? So they're feeling a little headache. Now, if you smoke your head and you have a headache, like that makes sense. but it should go away. By day like two, if that headache is still present, that's not just from the bump on the head anymore, potentially. Like go get it checked out, because the worst you're gonna do is you're gonna get it checked out and you're gonna get support early and you're gonna get it on the right track. So it's either gonna help you or be a neutral intervention versus delaying it a week or two or three and then going, you've just prolonged recovery. When with concussion, for example, like we want to get you going on a protocol with on day three. You know, an example of what, so my son's 10 and he scoots, like so he rides a scooter. And so we go to the pump track and literally I take my eyes off for like 10 minutes. He like rides this thing all the time. And then I hear crying. And I was like, oh no. And I look up, I was reading my book and I look up and I see this dad like walking my son out of the track and he is holding his head and he's screaming. The concussion expert mom is like, oh shit. Sorry if I'm not supposed to swear.
No, you're fine.
So I run over and his helmet, we would literally just said this morning, we're like, hey, dude, we can wear this helmet today, but like, we need to go get you a new helmet, like, as soon as we're done here. Well, his helmet had slid back on his head and he bailed on his scooter and he went headfirst into the concrete corner of the track.
Oof. That's painful.
Crying like a banshee, obviously. His head hurts. He has a massive, massive goose egg on his head. And I'm like, dude, like, once I finally got his like tears settled down, I'm like, do you feel like my head hurts? I'm like, of course your head hurts, buddy. You went into a concrete corner. I'm like, do you feel sick? He's like, no, my head just hurts. I'm like, okay. I like follow mom's finger, buddy. Like, mm-hmm. quick concussion screen on the sideline. Like, so basically I'm screening for red flags in that moment. Like, he goes fast on that thing and he went head first into a concrete corner. And I'm like, do I need to take him to hospital? No, red flags were clear. No symptoms beside his head hurting.
What are those red flags you're screening for in that immediate aftermath?
Yeah. So you're looking for loss of consciousness. You're looking for any like fluid coming out of like the nose or the ears. Any like weakness or tingling down the arms or the legs. Speech issues. Repeating sentences. Loss of consciousness. Any posturing or seizure activity. Vomiting. Blurred vision, those are all things that would take him to a hospital. Yeah. So making sure that none of those things were present. And so then I took him home, put an ice pack on his head. Obviously his head hurt still. Mm-hmm. I screened because symptoms don't always have to show up right away. They can show up. They can start showing up within like 4 to 6 hours, or depending when you start to do stuff again the next day, they can show up the next day. So for him, it's also very different when it's your kid. Yeah. So we chilled that day. I, you know, screened vision a couple more times, like later again that day. The next morning he woke up, headache was gone. He had a cool bump on his head, completely asymptomatic. Vision screening was fine. All symptomatics were fine. So that's a scenario where everything was good within 12 hours. He did not have a concussion. He didn't have to go to a clinic. So it's kind of that kind of element of things. Yeah.
I definitely remember my years of being a camp counselor. And when I first started off, you get a little bump to the head and they want you to go to the nurse, but then it's fine. And then I feel like a few years later, they take it so much more seriously that if you have a paper airplane fly into your head, they still want you to get screened to make sure you don't have a concussion from it. Have you found over the years that people take concussions more seriously than when you first started out?
100%, and thank gosh, yes. And I did a study, or no, I didn't do a study. Read a study that I presented about that said, you know, there's been a threefold increase in concussion in the last however many years. And it's that question of, is there actually a threefold increase in concussion, or is awareness just gotten that much better that we're now actually diagnosing concussion? Regardless, mm-hmm. I enjoy that the awareness is better and this is getting diagnosed, because the amount of people that still don't understand that some of the symptoms they have today that they're struggling with could be linked to their concussions from years before and they can still get better. So there is definitely an increase in the diagnosis of concussion. Is it because there's more concussions? Possibly, but is there also because there's a significant awareness? 100%, that's part of it as well, in my opinion. But yeah.
Do you think that it would seem, at least here in the States, there's been a lot of focus in professional sports, whether it's NFL football or NHL hockey, even in baseball, there's mm-hmm. much more awareness about concussion, that the leagues have concussion protocols that the teams are obligated to follow. Do you think there's a trickle down effect from that, that because the professional leagues are doing that, younger kids in younger leagues are having these injuries taken more seriously? I mean, I played sports all the time and I can think of times where I had jarring hits to the head and it's just like, ah, shake it off, you're fine. But that was also 30 years ago. So I'm curious what you see in the clinical and as a trickle-down effect from professional sports and media awareness that this is getting, just in overall what patients are seeking from you.
Yeah. So it's funny, you know, one of the most common reasons people still don't think they have a concussion?
Nope.
Because they don't play sport. So it's still one of the most common reasons people think they don't get a concussion. And so recognizing, generally speaking, that concussion obviously can happen from sport, but car accidents are one of the leading causes, and falls are the other leading cause, domestic abuse, workplace injuries, right? So concussion can come from anywhere. In terms of sport, I think what it does help with, seeing the professional leagues kind of take it more seriously, is that has induced a trickle-down effect of having protocols in the younger leagues. Versus if the professional athletes weren't taking it seriously, why did the amateur athletes need to take it as seriously? So I do think that that is probably trickled down to like Hockey Canada needing to have their protocols, and like our minor football associations, like taking the steps to put the protocols in. And in my local community, like I reach out to all those organizations and I'm like, can we do an education session? Like, can we train your sideline people on how to screen? Like, how do we do this properly? With any youth athlete or any like active human, really, they want to get back to their sport as quickly as they can.
Do you find those leagues are receptive, and the people you reach out to are receptive to the information?
Usually, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually. Certain ones are definitely more receptive than others. But again, yes. I mean, ultimately, it's phrasing it like, we want your athletes to play, but we want them to play safe. And so I'll always say to my athletes when they come through too, because just because your symptoms are better doesn't mean your brain is healed. And I'll say to every new kid that comes through, or every new athlete that comes through my clinic, I will say to them on that first appointment, there is going to be a period in time where you do not like me. I said, and you're not going to like me because you're going to say you want to play and I'm going to tell you no. I said, and at that moment, I need you to give me like another week. Because what's happening at that point is, A, I've set them up for the fact that like there's going to be a period where you're cursing my name, probably. And I'm setting it up for the fact that there's going to be a point, it never fails, it's always there. Their symptoms are gone. Objectively, I'm not seeing full kind of recovery in the things that I assess to clear them for full play yet. I usually, on average, need another week of them doing the work, and then I can clear them. And so when that moment comes up, then, you know, 2 weeks later or whatever, they're frustrated with me, I can say, remember that time? Remember I told you there's going to be a moment where you hate me? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, it's right now.
At least you give them fair warning.
Oh, and honestly, that has been one of the biggest actionable shit. Like, we need to set expectations for people. One of the biggest anxiety markers and think about in life in general, right? One of the biggest frustrations we have is when we have uncertainty. But if you set that expectation at the beginning, you're setting yourself up as the therapist successfully to then be able to treat and continue to have trust and rapport. And you're setting the client up early to be like, we're going to get you there. Mm-hmm. But there's also going to be this one window where like, you don't like me. And so it's been, and the, one of the last kids we worked with, he was this awesome 13-year-old kid from football. And he's like, Natasha, he's like, I really want to play. And I said, dude, remember when I told you? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, here it's today. And he just starts like laughing and shaking his head. I'm like, you'll get there. I promise. Like, but yeah.
Is that kind of a vulnerable period where the patient feels like they're there, but you know, as the clinician, they're not, and having them take that window seriously where it might feel better than it actually is?
So we actually call it the window of vulnerability. Now that name can come into different places. So typically for a lot of people, symptom resolution can start to happen within like that 10 to 14 day mark. But metabolically and objectively, the brain hasn't fully recovered yet, but they feel good. So if they were to get a second concussion in that window when metabolically they potentially haven't fully recovered, and objectively, think about it, like your brain isn't starting in a healthy spot, which means if you add another insult on top of that injury, you could make it worse and it's going to take even longer to recover. And that's what we're trying to avoid. Mm-hmm.
It feels like stopping a prescription early. Like your doctor says, take it for 2 weeks and they feel better, so they stop taking it early, and it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, that's a great analogy. I love that one.